Stone Symposium. My name is David Walden. I'm the chair of the session. I'd like to introduce our main speaker and the person who will be making the comments. Our main speaker this afternoon is Ron Molin. He's an architect in Salt Lake City. He grew up in northern Indiana. His father is originally from Springville. His mother's family is Polish Catholic. Interesting background. He attended the Indiana University and then got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Architecture in 1958 from the University of Utah. The name of his paper is Warehousing the Saints, the Coding Metaphor for the Contemporary Church. And we'll look forward to that. The comments will be made by Jay Bonarici. He's a professor of organizational behavior at BYU. He's been a bishop and I believe a state counselor, or a counselor in the state presidency. He's also on the board, national advisory. No, wait. I got it wrong here. What is it? The National Advisory Council or something with Sunstone? I don't know.
I'm on the board of trustees of Sunstone.
Okay, they're both heavily involved with Sunstone. I know that. This has just been my second experience at Sunstone, so I don't know too much about what you do here. But I really enjoy it. Okay, if there's what we're going to do, we'll have the paper by Ron Molin, and then we'll have some comments by Jay Bonarici. And in the last part of the session, I want you folks to feel free to ask any questions. Please speak up when you have any questions, and I will repeat them through the mic because we're going to be recording this session. You can purchase it later, of course. You probably know that already. Okay, I think we're ready.
We're talking about the CODI, which is the standard plan for the church. And let me just take a minute and show you a couple of diagrams, and then we'll go from there. This is the CODI. You see it all over the valley. It's usually in areas that have built a new chapel in the last 4 or 5 years. And its main characteristic is a vast roof and a very low wall. The one environment we're going to talk about is the stack truss, which is the basic structural concept of the coding. I'm not going to get too technical, so don't fool you. The stack truss is a small truss to put over the classroom and the corridor, and then they stack the larger truss on top. So it's kind of a structural innovation in a sense, as opposed to this is the same size church, but this is the English parish church, you can see the variation in height. The main purpose of the church of the 13th and 14th century is to open up the walls, and this is for stained glass and so forth, and this is for cheap blind buttresses. Really involves a lot of exciting structural issues. Okay, with that as the thing that's in the paper. Warehousing the Saints. The CODI, a metaphor for the contemporary church. The CODI is the church's single plan for a three-ward chapel. It is a building with a vast expanse of roof and low perimeter walls and has the appearance of a large building that somehow has sunk several stories into the ground. Without a sign out front, no one would guess it was a church. Minor variations are encouraged in the design of the perimeter walls and entrances. However, the relationship of wall to roof is so ill-proportioned that efforts to enhance the design are either irrelevant or counterproductive. Why then is this building being built when it totally violates the traditions of Christian architecture? Unfortunately, the reasons are not flattering. There are many givens in the long tradition of religious architecture. To begin with, the chapel consistently dominates the design. Towers and steeples often add even more emphasis. It is the symbol of worship for the community served. Inside the chapel, the high ceiling space is filled with light from large windows, the light again of symbolic importance. Aesthetics are of primary importance, and for centuries the church has been the pride of the community that built and used it. Cost and construction time were of no concern for a building dedicated to the Lord. The people were willing to give their best. A warehouse, on the other hand, is a simple and very clear function: storage. Materials in, materials stored, materials out. The entrance, usually an overhead door, is the most important architectural element of an otherwise simple, sterile building. Aesthetics are of no concern. The main goal of warehouse design is to achieve maximum space at minimum cost. The Cody, although claiming to be religious architecture, is in fact little more than a warehouse. It is a design committed to maximum space at minimum cost. The excuse for the vast roof is readily apparent. Asphalt shingles cost 80 cents a foot, and brick walls cost $10 a foot. The roof then is maximized, the walls minimized. It's that simple. Aesthetics are not a consideration. Neither is symbolism, for the chapel is hidden somewhere under the great roof with no hint of where it is. Neither is there natural light, for there are no windows. The great roof precludes even that possibility because skylights are forbidden by a church bureaucracy paranoid about roof leaks. No consideration is given to the community served. Only minor adjustments are allowed. After all, it is not the ward's building. The ward is only allowed to use it. The Gothic cathedral, built during the 13th and 14th centuries, was the result of many exciting structural innovations. Groin vaults and flying buttresses are good examples. The flying buttress, the most daring and ingenious, freed up the structure, allowing for the first time large openings in the high masonry sidewalls, which were then filled with brilliant stained glass. This marvelous ascending form of building has never been surpassed. The structural innovation of the Cody is the stacked truss, which was used initially not only to carry the roof but also as a bearing wall. It is an innovation achieving the complete reversal of the flying buttress, a kind of giant step backward. On top of that, the stacked truss turned out to be a building code violation. A truss cannot be used as a bearing wall. The innovation was no longer relevant, but that hardly deterred a bureaucracy enamored with the original concept and the cost savings from 9-foot-high perimeter walls. The great roof remained. But the stacked truss design requires all the walls to be lined up. Therefore, the chapel and cultural hall have to be the same width. A basketball court then determines the width of a worship space, a case of the tail wagging the dog, and what has to be a historical first. Of course, the chapel then has to have additional walls to give shape to an otherwise dreary box. So much for cost savings. The classrooms are found on the perimeter of the Cody for no symbolic reason. They simply fit beneath the low exterior wall. The classrooms have windows and are all that is seen from the exterior, except for the glass entrances on either side. But here, although unintended, occurs the building's real symbolism. Like the warehouse, the entrances are of prime importance architecturally. People in, people stored, people out. Three congregations processed every Sunday. The one benefit of a chapel with no windows is those using the chapel have no idea what time it is and should be less intimidating for those in sacrament meeting at 5 o'clock at night, but hardly appropriate symbolically for an organization committed to light and truth. The success of a meeting is more dependent on the power company than inspiration from on high. It is a worship space of synthetic light and reprocessed air, a total separation from God's creation. The roof itself, which could be playful instead, has stringent design requirements. Ridges are encouraged, valleys forbidden unless absolutely necessary. This is enforced by the church bureaucracy with a frightening fanaticism. Roof leaks are abhorred, and valleys tend to leak more than other areas of the roof. For thousands of years, men have built roofs with valleys, but when one central organization owns and manages a vast number of buildings, 1 or 2% with an occasional roof leak can look like a horrendous problem. Therefore, the roof with no valleys. Summing up then, in the last quarter of the 20th century, the restored gospel is often celebrated in the only design provided by the church building committee, easily identified by its great roof, a hidden chapel filled with synthetic light and reprocessed air that is totally void of any symbolism and in the final sense is closer to a warehouse. What has been violated? Almost everything in the book. It might be humorous if we were observing some strange cult, but we're not. We're talking about our buildings, and they're a disaster, spawned in the stale air of some committee room. How could this happen? What kind of an organization could produce this? More important, what kind of people would be willing to accept it? C. Wright Mills, in his book, The Power Elites, talks of the dangerous deterioration of democratic processes that occur where a trend develops of fewer and fewer making the decisions for the many. It is a process once started that is difficult to reverse and ultimately results in a power elite in total control of a mass society. This concept has direct application to the church today, and the reason I took time discussing the CODI is because it is the product of the few, of a power elite, that the many are expected to accept regardless of how ridiculous and inappropriate it is. The CODI is then a metaphor for the inconsistencies of the contemporary church. The premise of the paper is that the administration of the church has continually moved toward a power elite, and the membership has more and more been reduced to a mass society. It is a political process, a philosophy of management, found in many organizations and particularly clear in the church. First, I would like to discuss the process itself, then apply it specifically to the church. Number one, in order to achieve a power elite, the few must withdraw decision-making from the many, thus reducing the many to a voiceless, powerless mass society. The few must set themselves apart as having superior wisdom, knowledge, ability, therefore deserving of the power. Today, of course, control of the media is of prime importance so that only the positions of the power elite are presented. Two, in order for the power elite to maintain control, the many or the mass society need to understand that their opinions are not wanted. Since it is assumed that these decisions of the power elite are right and beneficial for everyone, other opinions are not required. Three, since there is no need for alternate opinions, the many are often reminded that there is also no hope for change in the existing order. If and when change does occur, it will be at the discretion of the power elite. Four, control is maintained by making sure only those loyal to the power elite are given the authority to manage the many. Any community control locally is threatening to the process and must be replaced by a powerless mass looking to the chosen representatives of the power elite for all the answers. With these four points in mind, I would like to go through them again and demonstrate how the church is a good example of a power elite controlling a mass society. One, the evolution of the few taking over the control of the many has been in continual process since the founding of the church. And the church today is more centrist than any time in its history. New technologies in communication and transportation make that possible. The church in Rome never enjoyed this level of control. A good example is the highly sophisticated system the church has for gathering money, with every penny returned to the center and then controlled by the men at the top. Two, we are told by the authorities that there is no need for discussion or debate. In fact, there is no vehicle for the members to respond, for any response is discouraged. What is said and done at the top is assumed to be inspired, beneficial for the many, and the leaders show little curiosity about how their inspired programs are working. Three, the general authorities have made it clear that changes will not occur in the existing order until they deem it necessary, and they in turn are the only ones empowered to make the change. Again, the message is clear that members needn't bother with issues. 4. The general authorities maintain control of the membership by picking local leaders who are loyal to the authorities first and not the community served. Stake presidents, in effect, are representatives of the general authorities, and they in turn choose the bishops. Thus, total control is sustained easily from the top, with no questions and no complaints. The Mormon Church then exemplifies a power elite in control of a mass society, which begs the question, was that the purpose of the restored gospel? Was the membership meant to be reduced to a mass society? Was the leadership meant to be a power elite? The church was never a democratic organization, nor was it meant to be. It is a theocracy led by men of God. And what has happened is not the result of evil motives, but rather the result of a long and subtle process, a political process. But a power elite and a mass society are nevertheless the result and are hardly consistent with the fundamental ideals of the faith. And for these reasons. 1. The idea of the few directing the many is antithetical to the concept of a lay priesthood, a priesthood available to all male members of the church. We teach them correct principles and they rule themselves was once an accepted premise. Unfortunately, the lay priesthood has been drained of its decision-making power, reducing it to a men's organization that fits comfortably into a mass society. Also, the ward, once a healthy, well-defined community with its own operating budget plus ownership of its buildings, had to be replaced. A vital community stirs things up, asks questions, has demands. The new powerless ward is merely a local organization that goes through 3 hours of meetings each Sunday, ideal for a mass society. Of course, from the beginning, apostles and prophets were meant to lead, but not exclusively through power. They were also meant to serve with love, tolerance, and understanding. Leadership was shared. It had to be. For only recently, with new means of communication, was total control even possible. 2. In the early church, the members found the leaders readily accessible. Two-way communication was common and indispensable for establishing the Great Basin Kingdom. Of course, as the church grew, this accessibility became more difficult, but that did not negate the necessity. But as the leadership evolved into a power elite, it no longer wanted to listen. Two-way communication not only became impossible, but was considered suspect. Members were warned not to question the brethren. A large bureaucracy developed, insulating the power elite even further. The bureaucracy, of course, never questioned the brethren. Thus, the separation was complete. The power elite was wrapped in a protective cocoon of paid servants. This condition was never meant to exist, nor does it make sense. Good leadership has always been curious about how effective it is. Any organization with no vehicle for response from its members is a tyranny, demonstrating an unconscionable arrogance. I use the CODI as a metaphor for the many problems, inconsistencies, failures, because architecture has a way of exposing what is really happening in a culture. The CODI, a dull-witted bureaucratic disaster which no one likes, let alone could look on with any sense of pride, is being repeated over and over again. And why? Because an isolated, indifferent leadership is either too busy or not curious enough to find out how well it's working. 3. The idea of a fixed agenda with no alternatives and with no hope of changes unless deemed necessary by the power elite is antithetical to the whole idea of free agency and eternal progress. It does not take advantage of the extraordinary resources of its membership. And by limiting priesthood as well as leadership to a single gender, the church is cheated even more. Experiments should be encouraged. New programs developed at the local level. Dullness sets in from mindless conformity. There is almost always a better way. Yet the leadership attempts through correlation and social pressure, not to mention the psychological weaponry of guilt, to hold the membership within the tight restraints of a mass society. Warned often about alternative voices, we are nevertheless here today celebrating our free agency, and I believe hoping that things can change. And they do occasionally. Someone somehow got through to the top, and changes were made in the temple ceremony that were totally out of touch with the century. So there is hope, despite the constant reminders from the leadership that there isn't. Four, the Mormon community, the ward of the past, was a sociological showpiece of Mormonism. It was a balanced, warm, intelligent community in which to live and raise a family. The bishop was chosen on the basis of his ability to lead the community rather than loyalty to a remote leadership. I would guess that most of you here have an interest in the church today that is based more on memories of the past than present experience, and the ward, as it once was, is primarily responsible. Unfortunately, a territorial, demanding community got in the way of an ever-growing church. The community was streamlined, diminished so that control from the top could be complete. Even the limited financial power of the stake was withdrawn because money was being raised for playgrounds and other community facilities. By limiting donations to tithing, the power elite again took control. Even leaders of their own choice were no longer trusted to disregard local needs, and the funding of local needs is now determined by the level of conformity of the congregation. Temple work, missionary work, and the payment of tithes comprise the simple formula for life in the mass society and makes little contribution to the local community. It sustains the power elite. More important to the members is the quality of the community, the effectiveness of youth programs, the relevance of the faith in daily living. But this is not the agenda of a power elite with world aspirations for the church. Clearly, this paper has been critical of a power elite, but even more critical of members of a mass society willing to accept that role. They have slowly been programmed to accept the intolerable, one small step at a time. But there are problems. Young people, thinking people, are not willing to participate in a mass society. I see it in my own family. I see it in the children of friends. They are not buying the system. And even though I must respect their attitude, I find it unfortunate. They are unwilling to stay in and struggle. Perhaps it's because they have few memories of how it used to be. We are losing many of the best. If we have learned anything from Eastern Europe recently, it is that people have power, and they can force change if the will is there. And if they do it honestly, fairly, and intelligently, they can produce a better society. The church leadership requires a sustaining vote. I would hope that someday the members would take that sustaining power seriously and respond honestly and sincerely. A change in direction is required. Perhaps it will come from the women. They, after all, have a cause. Man was never meant to participate in a mass society directed by a remote power elite any more than he was meant to worship in a warehouse. He was meant to breathe and think and worship in an environment free and hopeful and full of purpose. And when something is wrong, out of balance, not functioning, he must speak out. To criticize bad decisions is not a sin. It is an obligation. Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to respond to Ron's paper. I've spent a professional lifetime criticizing organizations and trying to change them. And I find it both an ecstatic and a very discouraging activity, because most organizations don't change. But on the other hand, most organizations die. The normal state of an organization is to die. Mark Twain said that people would sooner die than think, and most do. And organizations would sooner die than change, and most do. Of all the organizations existing today, in 5 years, 95% of them will be gone. because organizations do not have built in the natural capacity. They are not a natural system. They are not a biological system with the concept of homeostasis and equilibrium evolving to modify it. In the absence of humanly contrived mechanisms to bring it about. And so what Ron is talking about is the absence of those humanly contrived mechanisms that would do what he would want to do. And that's hard to do, by the way. That is very difficult. And I guess one response that I would have to his issues, and a response I have in general to people who are frustrated with organizations, and I think that includes all of us, from time to time, whether we're dealing with a very small family or a very large nation or world organization or something in between of a business or a church or a political or a social system. One approach, and I would argue a first approach, ought to be to understand the process, ought to be an inquiry into the science of organization and the evolving organizational forms, in addition to the very legitimate and very important criticisms of where that organization is. Now, in no way do I demand that a person have a solution before they criticize. I think that is a very empty bureaucratic excuse to turn off comment. I don't think that a person needs to have an answer, and somebody says, well, can you do it any better? And the answer may well be no, but that doesn't preclude me from criticizing the way you're doing it. Because I have every right, and not only right, Ron would add, and I would agree, a responsibility to give people the feedback they need to do it better, even though you do not have the expertise, even though you do not have the solution already worked out. You have other things to do, like a job perhaps, like a family perhaps, like sleep and cooking food or whatever. You don't have an infinite amount of time to formulate and communicate proposals as to how organizations should be run better. And therefore, do not let anyone push you into the corner of saying you have no right to criticize unless you have a solution or a better way. You have every right to, because other people are charged with the responsibility of managing organizations, and people ought to give them very good feedback, accurate feedback, not loaded, not cynical, not arbitrary, but good data as to how the organization is doing. And any really good organization leader will seek that out. The problems we have is that there are not very many good organization leaders in the world. It's hard to do. It's very difficult. Because for the same reason you don't have time to work out all the solutions before you make a criticism, they don't have time to work out all the problems either. They also need sleep and food, and they get tired, and they get very worn out. And so they don't always think of these things, especially as organizations do go through life cycles. And I think it's important to realize that organizations tend toward conservatism. And organizations tend toward convergence. And I think we need to understand that. Using a very simple metaphor of a cone, there's no means to write, and I don't know how anyone in the world would ever expect me to talk without writing. But that's okay. Yeah, think of a cone, just a very simple cone as a metaphor. All organizations tend toward the bottom of the cone for a very simple reason. People want control and predictability. It's a natural state. And you have to reverse that state to change the organization and to change the process. And so you have to become aware of it, and you have to understand it. So organizations tend down to the bottom of the cone. Now, from the management perspective, the attempt is to get more and more control. And the process is simple. As you go down, you get more and more control over less and less, until finally you have perfect control over nothing. That is a very parsimonious explanation of the evolution of many of the Eastern European states, is that more and more control over less and less, till finally have perfect power over nothing. Now think of that in terms of any organization. The tendency's down. While the tendency of the freewheeling liberal is to kick the organization up that cone into infinite space. And no organization can exist there either. Organizations can exist neither at the bottom nor at the infinite space of the cone. And so the reality of organizational life is a dynamic tension between the apex, the point of the cone, and infinite space. You need some structure, but too much will destroy you. And who has the wisdom to put you at the right amount of structure? We have not yet found that person. We have not yet found a revelation that offers it, nor a wisdom that results in it. And so, it's a dynamic tension of human interaction, of people pulling and pushing, of bureaucrats writing more and more policy manuals, and then realizing that they have more policy manuals than they have people to implement policy, and the weight of the policy manuals brings the organization down. And the weight of correlation or any other process in the organization can do the same. But you've got to realize that the tendencies are in that direction. Because once you put a person in a leadership management role, they surrender the majority of life's alternatives. And their focus becomes narrowed, and it becomes managing that organizational process. And so they want to make it better. And it's usually not an ignoble control motive. Sometimes it is. But it usually is not. Usually it's an attempt to bring logic. For example, Ron mentions the loss of power in a ward. I've interviewed a lot of bishops lately, and I found a lot of bishops that are really fairly pleased with what's happened for two reasons. One of which is that they have less hassle raising money, but there's another, or managing a ward budget, but there's another very important reason that is sort of a dynamic tension to Ron's point. And that is, a lot of these people are saying, I now have a lot more time to minister rather than administer. And I've talked to a lot of bishops and a lot of students and members of a resident ward that I go to who find a very pleasing outcome in that process. More time spent serving genuine needs. More time spent responding to genuine purposes. And to responding to kids, or responding to widows, or responding to somebody that needs that kind of response, that is sapped by the administrative process that can overwhelm a bishop. A few years ago we did a study, a group of us did a study on the role of the bishop. And the results were scary. We found that the average ward was demanding 32 hours a week from a bishop. That is excessive time. And the actual range was from 16 to 74 hours a week in terms of what bishops were putting in. Now, a lot of them were putting in time to make people think and make themselves think they were important. And they were wasting a lot of time with the illusion of activity instead of accomplishment and effectiveness. But a lot were just worn down and are not very efficient and not very good administrators, and I understand that. But what we found was that the program demands are so excessive that there's not a lot of time left for a lot of people to minister. And so by a motive that does in fact result in some things being more centralized, results in other things being less centralized, with more discretionary time to do more good things, if you take advantage of that discretionary time, and if you initiate action to, in fact, serve people and do what ought to be done in a ministering context. So I would only point out the dynamic tension and the dichotomy of centralized administration. When General Motors centralized under Alfred P. Sloan, people talked about a centralized process, and then they talked about decentralized results. And both were true. General Motors centralized finance and decentralized production and operations. And in the process, they did both simultaneously. And I see both in the Mormon ward. Now, some people complain at those things that are centralized, and they ought to complain. Others are pleased with some of the things that are decentralized, and it may be a default decentralization in some cases, just less program time. Now, other people are going to seek for more program activity to absorb the program time to provide a natural excuse for not doing the things that ought to be done, like visiting the people that need to be visited, like loving the people that need to be loved, like putting the arm around the person that needs the arm around them. We can all find grand excuses not to do that, but some are astute enough to find an excuse to do it in lesser program demands, in lesser administrative processes, in lesser activities. On one occasion, when I was a bishop, we built our own ward. And we built a very creative ward with a lot of money and a lot of activity that went into some very unique features. Some of that was really fun, but some of it was very frustrating and tiring and inefficient and wasteful in terms of money and time. Now, in another ward context, where we took a more standard program, a lot of people were a little frustrated at the CODI system that Ron accurately and insightfully offers to us. But they were also very pleased at the lack of involvement that they needed. Now, does that lack of involvement give them an excuse for not being part of the community? It can. Does it free them up to do some other more worthwhile things? It can. But in both cases, it depends on the individual. And so, in the final analysis, we can never totally default to the organization, either as an excuse for not doing what we ought to do, or as an incentive, take any credit, when they provide an incentive for doing it. In both cases, we're reduced in Sartre's terms to the fact that we are condemned to be free. We are condemned to choose whether we accept someone's order over us or not, or whether we use initiative to do something worthwhile or default, hiding behind the skirts of the program demands on us, under the guise of administrative expectation, of meeting attendance or whatever. And so in that process, we are forced to accept responsibility. A lot of us don't do it very openly and very, very vocally, but we are forced to accept responsibility for how we choose to act with whatever kind of process runs. Now, a couple of other perspectives on some things. I like Ron's use of the metaphor. I like his use of the architecture as a metaphor. It's a very useful, very helpful, very insightful metaphor. There's lots of other metaphors that we use that can be very useful or very troublesome. I gave a B.H. Roberts speech many years ago on a very important metaphor dealing with Christ as the head or the heart of the church. And as the head of the church, we have administrative control. And you have those very troublesome comparisons to the two efficient organizations being the Prussian Army and the Mormon Church. And as a child, I thought that was a compliment. As an adult, I see it as an incredible indictment. But the point is, it is the symbol of the head and the control system, the mechanism for running the organization, which is a management function. And we have become very good at management. And we have replaced a classical leadership role in Mormon and corporate and political world with a bureaucratic management. See, a manager is a top-down control system. A leader is a bottom-up support system. And so when you have the tension between leadership and management, you have the mechanism of a classic pyramid with a manager on top pulling strings to get the control and to get the performance out of the subordinate participants in that organization and to make sure that they do it according to the manager's will. Now, there are some things that ought to be controlled, like money, because money can be squandered and we can have scandals, and we've seen them, and they're very troublesome. You see it in the savings and loan. You see an incredible lack of control in a monetary world that led to scandals. So that's a lack of good management. But the leadership is a bottom-up phenomenon. It's a support system rather than a control system. Management controls things. Leaders support people. Now, any organization structure can play to one or the other. Most play to control management. I've been part of an education system for several decades that I now am very worried about. And that's teaching MBA students how to be better control mechanisms in a society when what we need is better leadership. We've got great management control systems, and we need to get rid of a lot of them, and we need better leadership, more vision and better development. Well, that's the same issue in the church. The system tends to the bottom of the cone, which is a management control system, which will finally die of its own weight, but most of us don't want to wait for that. Most of us want to change in the meantime, and that's the leadership challenge. And it's a leadership challenge from the bottom up of the organization to provide feedback where it's needed. Some of you have heard me say, and I apologize for never fulfilling my assignment, but I was asked by the Ensign to write an article on strategies for disagreeing with church leaders. I struggled with that. I was asked 3 or 4 years ago, and I still haven't got it done. It is very difficult to do, because it either sounds like I'm selling out, or I'm just a syndicalist. either hell for hell-raising sake or selling out to compliance and obedience. And I haven't found a way to state the way I really feel. I'm still trying to write that article. It's encouraging that it was asked for. And it's troublesome that it's so difficult to produce. But the point is, it does depend in every case on a personal strategy for managing organizational involvement. And that strategy means giving good data to people, to leaders. It means approaching bishops and stake presidents and general authorities. Now, I have been asked many times for feedback on church programs by general authorities. And it's very interesting. I've written some reports. I've made some oral statements. Some have been accepted, some rejected. But the point is, I think there is an interest in responsible responses, but they don't know how to facilitate a process to get it. And so it's easy to say that they're interested, and it's easy to be interested and not know how to generate it. We do not have good organizational communication systems in any organization. And the bigger it gets, the more likely it won't go. And as organizations move on that upward growth phase to a mature maintenance phase, we turn management focus instead of leadership, we turn bureaucratic, and we turn control, and it's understandable why we do that. It may not be excusable, but it's understandable. And if we don't understand that, we will then be tilting at windmills instead of really addressing fundamental organizational problems. Anyway, I like the metaphor. I would suggest a metaphor of a heart instead of a head. I would suggest a metaphor of leadership instead of management. I would suggest a metaphor of individual responsibility rather than top-down control, even if somebody at the top wants it the other way around. It's always, we are condemned to be free. It always is up to us to provide that kind of process. Organizations are always compensations for something that's wrong. Always organizations are always compensating mechanisms for a lack of something. The production of food, the manufacture of goods, the protection of a state, or the community of saints. But the organization can never provide it. As John Gardner argues in Grendel, Beowulf from the standpoint of the monster, organizations are always evil. Not just a little bit evil, but monstrously evil. And I agree. Organization is always taking away the freedom of the individual. And people must always fight back, eternal vigilance in any organization. And people must fight back, not with the purpose of destroying the organization, but of transcending the organization, of making the organization a means. Community is never a result of organization. It's a response to it. And people must respond. Ron mentions the nostalgia of the old ward. I don't quite have his nostalgia of the old ward. The support systems I have found have never been in the ward structure. They've always transcended it. I've always had to create them, and friends of mine have always had to create them, and sometimes we're in the same ward, but usually we were not. But the organization gives us something to jump off of, a stepping stone, but never, never a retreat, never a final position. Always a means to an end. And in that means, I meet people, I learn things, and then with that, I organize community action. I organize communities for me and for others within the framework of the church or in the larger community. But the individual must do it. The church can never do it for you. A priesthood quorum, a relief society can be a starting point, but it has never been adequate in my observation. It does many things that can only be done through the mechanism of a strongly structured organization. But we must then transcend it and never be victimized by it. Well, organizations, you know, my purpose in life is to help people protect themselves against the abuse of organizations. That's my only purpose. That's why I teach in my field. I don't believe we can ever make organizations safe for people. We can only make people safe for organizations by making them strong enough, secure enough, informed enough, confident enough, competent enough to transcend what will always be a lot of negative forces in that organization. But with that, we can change some of those negative forces, and it is being done in many places, and we can be part of that in Mormon culture, and we've seen some of those changes. And we will see more. And I hope we will see more, and I hope we will allow for those changes and for those forces to be seen as attempts to accomplish good things with many, many negative consequences that need to be understood and communicated and changed. And I would hope that we would not only be up to the process, but that we would enjoy the process and make it a fun crusade. Thank you.
Okay, we have time for some questions right here. Okay, let me repeat the question. As I understood it, you're asking if the temples are following the same pattern as chapels, becoming more oriented towards mass culture or numbers, etc., and ignoring other aesthetic, spiritual values, basically. Okay. Right.
I'm sure Ron will have some good responses to that, but. Let me make it really clear. I am not at all enthused about the Kodi. I try to find explanations of the process, but don't hear it as a defense of the outcome. I think we've got to understand the process before we develop a good defense to it. And I feel even more strongly, I share your position in terms of the temple. But on the other hand, the economy of money, you know, the worldwide church with a lot of people who don't have money, as you meet with the saints in the Philippines and in areas of the world where they don't have resources. I have a mixed response. As I went through the temple in the Philippines with people who really can't afford anything much more, and see how pleased they are and how they are using that as a community kind of process, even though you might challenge the architecture in terms of the Salt Lake Temple or in terms of a Gothic cathedral, there is a trade-off, and it may be too much, but there is an attempt to provide for a lot of people things that they couldn't otherwise have. And you think you're squeezing three programs through. You know, we're going to go to four and five in a day, in a Sunday, in terms of the economy of building buildings in the larger areas of church concentration. We'll have to go to a two-hour schedule to do it, but that's what we're going to do. And in that process, we can squeeze more through, and we're saving money, or are we? We're saving time, or are we? We're being efficient, or are we? Is it at the expense of spiritual? Now, at the risk of arguing against your point, the first time I went to the temple, we didn't have all these mass-produced, efficient temples. It was a long time ago, with no movies, and I didn't much care for it then either, frankly. So I guess I'm being a little cynical in terms of the fact that we may be blaming an indigenous problem on a contemporary explanation that may not be the whole story. spirituality has always been transcendent for me and has never worked very well with the ward or the stake or the temple. So, you know, we're all different. And let's accept and honor that distinction and recognize that it does mean different things. But I've seen some pretty different responses in different parts of the world. And I wonder, maybe cheaper chapels are better for some people. But then what do you do with those that can afford better and want to put in a beautiful pipe organ? Do you deny them that? And that's a real tension for me. I've overstated my case, Ron.
I really don't want to comment on Mormon temples because I think they're so outrageous that I can't even begin to think about them. The reason we have three and five congregations in a typical Mormon ward is not that it enhances the function of the ward, but basically we have a central church trying to become a world church in a hurry, and the Wasatch Front, basically, with all the church growth throughout the world, still packs two-thirds of the bill. So we haven't grown with financial power to do what we're doing without really attacking something I think is very critical, and that is that, number one, you do not have a community unless a community has a territory that they control totally. And once you give that up, you are something else other than a community. And we lost that when the church took over ownership and we run three congregations through a week.
Okay, back here.
Is there any possibility for us to institute within the church an ombudsman system or an inspector general that allows for faculty feedback? When I was very young, we had easy fact feedback because I and my neighbors all knew at least one general authority. So we'd go over and talk to him. He was a neighbor. He was a guy who lived up the street. Brigham Young knew almost all of the people in the church. Now, we can't do that now. It's much too big. Can we use ombudsman instead?
Okay, the question is, can we have some kind of ombudsman system to a feedback system for the church?
We had two apostles that were in our ward, but they were wonderful men, but they weren't the kind you'd talk to.
It makes it hard with the corporate church. Different kinds of people are selected for leadership, and they are managers, and they're managing an organization that's very complex, and it is hard to get that. I don't know. Ombudsman is an awkward concept in the church organization. I don't know if that would work or not. I remember when we introduced the regional representatives, I was on a committee looking at church structure, and the issue was that up until that time, every state president had a general authority that they could call for information. And the need for the new structure came when there were a series of state presidents that no longer had a friend who was a member of the quorum. And I remember that happening vividly. And how are we going to run the church given that? We've got to become bureaucratic. I remember the tension in that discussion. We've got to become bureaucratic, and the hostility expressed by some general authorities in terms of that, that that's going to destroy that whole process as we become a management organization, a bureaucratic organization, rather than a smaller human organization. I don't think that's the answer, frankly. I don't have a simple answer. But I don't see that one as fitting the culture.
Okay, here in front.
I think Ron's described very carefully a lot of the problems that a lot of us see. Ron Ritchie has given an explanation of the fact that it's a bureaucracy, a large organization, all those sorts of things. It seems to me that we always excuse what Ron's problems that he defines by saying that it's a large organization. We understand it's a large organization. Shouldn't we expect more from the Church of Jesus Christ than another large organization? That's what I would say.
Okay. The question is, shouldn't we expect more from the church than just having it be another large organization?
Yes.
Clearly. But we ought to expect more of ourselves, too. We are part of that organization. And I think I hear a lot of members defaulting in that process of expecting more of themselves in making that large organization work for themselves.
I think, though, as the organization focuses toward the bottom of the cone, then there is no things are so fixed by then that there aren't the opportunities for individual expression. Can't have any paintings and award. Anyway, there aren't any opportunities for individual expression, nor are there opportunities for community expression, for communities of specific local needs, like some kind of arrangement for a ward with a lot of older people, or an arrangement for a bunch of young couples with kids, where maybe both parents have to work. Now, we don't adjust, or we don't look at those kinds of problems at all, or tend to relate to them. And I think a religious community should. And I think there are some terrific possibilities, and there are some great things being done in other communities, other religious groups. We ought to look around.
But we could, Ron. Ward, where I was bishop, we collected $50,000 outside of the church distribution system. We cooperated with the Black Economic Development League in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We developed daycare centers. We built homes. We taught kids and young children construction skills. We raised this money independent of the church process. We opened a trust fund. The state president was Carl Hawkins, who was a remarkable person in the process. I was bishop of the ward. And we did all kinds of things that were really very exciting. We had some people who withheld their budgets, some even withheld tithing to contribute to this fund. But the point is, a lot of people did it anyway. And we had a whole program going. It was elaborate, involved with the Black community of Ann Arbor and Detroit. And it was an ecstatic experience for those who were involved in that process. We didn't ask for permission. We didn't wait to be told to do it. We responded. We created a community above and beyond the war.
But there is no independent funding today. That would not be possible to raise.
Sure, it would be possible. I would not hesitate for a minute to do it today.
I wouldn't either, but I think that's very much against policy.
You wouldn't take that risk. A lot of people wouldn't take that risk.
Yeah, but a lot of people wouldn't do it then. Most people wouldn't do it then.
Well, shouldn't we have incentives rather than disincentives?
That's a good point. Sure, sure, we ought. Sure, sure. But I'm saying even without some of the disincentives, not much happened. There's great examples in Boston. There's some great examples in some California wards, San Francisco, the Bay Ward in San Francisco in terms of dealing with gay members was an incredible local creative experience to respond in the presence of a very high structure organization. But yeah, we ought to have the incentives, for sure. But it can still be done.